With me at the SNCC office in San Francisco, Mr. Stokely Carmichael, Chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Mr. Carmichael, could you take us back to your earliest years and where you grew up and what surroundings and some of the experiences that shaped your attitudes and beliefs?
Well, I was born in Trinidad, which was then the British West Indies, which was controlled by Britain. We've since gained independence, but we're still economically controlled by Britain. And that one of the things of the island was that it was at least 90, or I'd say it was 99% non-white, the largest percentage of that being black. And then there were some Orientals, I considered East Indians black. So that all of the functions and the positions of power were carried out by black people. All the government positions, my school teachers, principals, chief of police, ministers, etc. So that there was never any question in my mind as to whether or not a black person could hold those positions of power. Now, when I came to the United States, I was 10, going on 11, the complete converse of that happened, that wherever there were positions of power, there were always white people and no black people at all. So that the question arose, in my mind as to whether or not black people in the West Indies were different from black people in America, in the United States, since black people in the West Indies could easily do these jobs and they were not doing it in the United States. After I came to the conclusion that there was no difference between black people in the United States and black people in the West Indies, then I said there must be a reason then why black people are not in those positions of power. And it became clear to me that they were being denied, they were being oppressed and kept out. So that the question was that black people had to build a power base so that they could control those institutions inside their own community, certainly since upon coming to the United States, we lived inside a ghetto, which was dominated by whites.
So this is the genesis of really the black power theme, the entire theme of black power. It's your, as far as you're concerned with it and your articulation and evolution of it. But what about going back to the West Indies for a minute? Did you you've mentioned that there were police and government officials and so forth who were black, but there were, I imagine, subtle forms of discrimination that were practiced there, weren't there? Did these really impinge on you very much?
No, because the whites who lived there lived in big houses off to themselves, but they were so about less than half of 1% of the population. The only question that ever arose in my mind was how come they were allowed to live in such big houses when the black population lived so poorly. Then I began to raise questions after I left the West Indies in terms of how is it that the black population was so poor, and I began to see that it was because the island was being economically exploited by Britain and the United States, which has since moved in there.
Well, this is true of most of the raw materials producing countries with colored populations. The structure of economic relations is designed to produce cheap raw materials by low labor wages in the colonies and support, therefore, the standard of living in the mother countries. So this was a pattern, and you saw that as a pattern, I imagine, did you?
Yeah, but I wasn't as politically sophisticated to put it together. There was only one act, really, in my childhood days that I remember as being that of discrimination, which did stick in my mind. It's a savanna in Trinidad, which is a large area of grass where horse racing goes on and all sorts of festivities. And we went there one Sunday, and there were signs saying, keep off the grass, and I was with my aunt. And I walked on the grass, and there was a white kid on the grass, and the police officer made me get off the grass. He was a black police officer and did not ask the white kid to get off the grass. And my aunt asked him, why didn't he do that? At which point he sort of shrugged his shoulder and walked away. But that's about the only act in the West Indies that even began to, for me to raise questions. I just never raised any questions about that.
What about schooling there? You started schooling, I take it, in the West Indies.
I certainly did, and went to one of the best schools on the island, a private school, because we were from the aristocracy in the West Indies. And there were white students there who whose parents were from England and who were serving as British consulates or what have you, so that...
Colonial service people and army people.
Right. Mm-hmm. And their children were sent to the school. And there was that, since I was young then, a certainly social interaction just in terms of the sports. We all played soccer together and cricket, and there was... they were included in all of the mischievous acts that we would continue. Obviously, I left before I would have grown old enough to then start raising questions about sex and race, that is, which would have brought about this split-up. We didn't visit each other's houses, but merely because we lived in different parts of the island, and the school was a special school, a private school, so that it was not unusual for people to live in different parts, so that... My schoolmates were my schoolmates, and my friends at home were my friends at home, because they came from the neighborhood, and at school everybody came from different areas.
So there wasn't school segregation, but there was residential segregation of a sort then?
Well, not even, because if there would have been, I mean, if I went to the local school around my neighborhood, then all the people would have been black. Because again, the black-white was never heightened, because there weren't that many white people.
Right. Well, what about the political... of course, you were too young then, I suppose, at the age of 10 to develop any political ideas, but do you recall any things being talked about at the time in your home, for instance, or among your father's friends and things? Were there any political ideas beginning to filter through to you?
My aunt was very political, and she still is. She's now involved with the Eric Williams faction in Trinidad. And she'd always been very political, and so we'll always be talking about the different wagings of the political parties and the fact that the white people in reality really controlled the island, and that there was no way for black people to break that. That is, in her own frustration when she would speak. I just got a glimpse of it, for example, whenever there would be people over the house who would be discussing that politically. But too young to really grasp and understand it until now, when I recall certain statements that I could remember her saying. I guess that had some sort of importance in terms of I do remember those statements and remember those settings in the dining room with people drinking tea and talking about the bloody Americans and the dirty English. and of course there was a prostitute house right above the place where we lived. And that was my first introduction to Americans. American sailors would pass by my house, totally drunk, go on their way up to the prostitute house, and then return using abusive language to all of us who were in the streets. It was my first and only introduction to Americans, whom everybody on the block hated with a passion. Because of their attitude. The attitude was that they were automatically better than everybody else, and that they had money which they would, and candy which they would throw at us, you know, when they'd come by. In our neighborhood, we didn't take the candy. In poorer neighborhoods, they did. And so they're trying to throw more candy just infuriated us more and more, to the point where the older boys began to beat them up when they would come down at night from the prostitute house, just completely drunk and very abusive. That's all I could remember about my only contact with Americans.
You weren't thinking of the Americans there as representing something in America that's related to the treatment of the Negroes in America. This was purely the context in which you saw them in Trinidad.
No, I would assume they would have done that in any other country. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't make a difference. It's just an attitude that Americans grow up with, that they are, in fact, the greatest, and that the world owes them something, because they seem to be the ones who save the world, since they give aid to everybody, what they call aid.
Did you, as youngsters growing up there, hear anything about what was happening in the southern United States and the lynchings that went on through the 20s and 30s, for instance?
No, we didn't hear about that, because most of that time was preoccupied with Gandhi's revolution in India, which was much closer to the island. In terms of the head, it has a large segment of the Indian population. And the Korean War was also...
So you saw some of this nonviolent protest activity.
Oh, yes, certainly. Gandhi was hot news, you know, on the island. I remember on my way from school passing through squares. You know, we have squares where there would be always arguments going on. Well, I couldn't understand it. As boys, we would just sort of sit around and listen just to watch the actions of the people who were debating. They're just squares where people would come and sit and debate about Gandhi. East Indians and black Americans would continually be debating about the right of Gandhi. But there was a faction, a strong faction, that talked about the terrorist groups inside of India. And their point was always that Gandhi... one thing I do remember about them was their point was that Gandhi is not going to win this revolution. The terrorists will really win it. And that Gandhi's strength was the fact that the English knew that if he was killed, the terrorists would take over. Mm-hmm. And that's why they, in fact, would rather deal with Gandhi than to deal with the terrorist. That sets in my mind pretty clearly. I mean, after I've come to think of it. But the United States itself was just seeing something far off... which was the best thing in the world, as it was represented on the island, even better than England, incidentally. And the only contact with Americans were the sailors, and that was all.
What were relations like between the Negro blacks and the East Indians? Were they good? Was there developing solidarity there?
Or? Oh, there was. I mean, there was like no one saw them as being any different, except as a matter of fact that there was an ill name for Indians, which they called coolies, and that some black people called them coolies. So that sometimes they looked as a lower class. But there was no rigid discrimination among the East Indians then, as I can remember. I understand that there has been some faction going on the island between them.
There were differences of religion and customs with regard to food and so forth. Did this stand out at all in your mind, or was it irrelevant?
No, it was irrelevant because we used to eat a lot of Indian food. I mean, curry and rice and roti.
Was there much intermarriage between the Indians?
Yeah, there was.
There was
a lot of intermarriage. Yeah.
In British Guiana, there was some conflict between the Indian and the Negro population there, and it took a political form, this division, which the British then exploited, of course.
Right, I think, but that was because they were close, 50-50.
Yeah. The East Indians were a minority in Trinidad, were they?
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. I take it from what you've said that your father was relatively well-to-do then, if you went to a private school, is that right?
Well, yes and no. My father was in America. I didn't know my father. He left the West Indies when I was very young. I didn't meet him until I came to the United States again.
He was American-born, or...?
No, he was West Indian Trinidadian-born. My mother came to the United States with her mother right after my sister, Lynette, was born. She's the third child. There's one older than me, Yumilta. And... my father then came immediately after that, so that he left when I was about two, I imagine, so that I had no concept of him. And I grew up with my aunts and my grandmother. So my father could then afford to send money back to the West Indies to take care of us, which then would mean that every American dollar he sent to the West Indies was worth about $1.70-something in those days. So that it appeared that... and certainly for the island, yes, we would be wealthy.
Was this a common thing for Trinidadians to go to America and work and send money home?
Yeah, it was very, very common, very common.
A lot of people who've gone to England have done that, send money back to India and West Indies.
It was very common, so that we were certainly included in the well-to-do, just in terms of financially, as at least we were the children of my father. My father's relatives with whom I lived were not considered so, and that they didn't have a name or tradition within the island. We just had the money. That is to say that if I had stayed in the West Indies, I would now have represented the nouveau riche, let's say, in the West Indies.
About the, you were talking earlier about whether American Negroes are different from West Indian Negroes and so forth. Have the Negroes in the West Indies had more continuity of features of African culture?
Yes, absolutely.
Because of they didn't have the deliberate breaking off of the whites and so on.
We're not cut off. The African slave route, first stop-off point, was in fact the West Indies, and that there were large plantations on the West Indies, but there was smaller percentage of whites. That is, the blacks outnumbered the whites, mm-hmm. and most of the whites were Scottish, Irish, and Welsh. But that they didn't attempt to do what America did, because the threat of the slaves, I think, taking over the island was not imminent for some reason, I guess, as it was here in the United States. So that there wasn't that splitting up and dividing and trying to keep the slaves away. And then, of course, the plantation system was broken down very early, too, in the West Indies.
Were there Negro plantation owners to any extent?
Yeah, there were some black plantation owners in the, I imagine, the early slave mm-hmm. areas, slave days. But that slavery wasn't such a big thing in the West Indies. What was really needed was the pitch and the oil that Sir Walter Raleigh found mm-hmm. in the island, and that's when the island began to develop economically around the Pitch Lake, which, of mm-hmm. course, seems
yes.
to be...
Trinidad asphalt or
right,
something
is incessant, so that, and that slaves weren't needed to do that, mm-hmm. and that's where the economy of the island really began to move, and there was some fishing being done then off of the island, but its main economy became the asphalt.
So through this continuity of some of Africa's culture, the blacks in the West Indies have more knowledge of African ways and customs, and actually this is part of their heritage.
And remember, they were then a majority in the island, so that they could keep.
Yes.
And the island is only, 48 miles wide and 72 miles long.
They could support the institutions of this culture, couldn't they?
Yeah. And keep it up outside the island. Inside the island they can keep it up. In America, however, the slaves were just split up, and the area was so vast, and they were a minority, that whites could just split them up and keep them apart, but it'd be too difficult to do in the West Indies. Yeah. So there was that black consciousness always present in the West Indies, which was deliberately depleted in the United States.
You know, the white popular image of African culture that's remained in the West Indies is voodoo, but there must be much more than that in family customs. In voodoo is only a part of religious rites in some parts of Africa, I believe, but there must have been much more in terms of family customs and value systems and so forth, and perhaps some language. Did some words carry over?
There's, for example, I never learned it, but Patois was a dialect which many people in the West and in Trinidad speak. And certain areas of the West needs, and certainly does have an African dialect to it, Patois does. But I think the consciousness of Africa was not as strong as the consciousness of blackness. That is, I don't even remember myself. I even remember going to the theaters on Saturdays and watching the British movies of Tarzan and yelling for Tarzan to beat up the black people in Africa. So there was certainly a distinction those days. I think that gap has certainly been closed and tightened up upon now, but there was a difference in terms of seeing Africa through the eyes of Tarzan movies.
Yes. You were seeing it very much through the eyes of an English schoolboy, or in the same way as he gets these
right.
visions, these images. Yeah. This aunt of yours who was politically motivated. Was she able to engage in politics so that you had some sense of some participation?
She was very much engaged in politics, and there was always political discussions. I mean, she was always rallying around one man in the government or the other. And
were there blacks standing for government, for the legislature and for government posts?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, very much so.
This, of course, is after the war now. I forget we are different generations.
This is after World War II. Yes, there certainly were. And her awareness of that politics is what really helped me, I think, to begin to develop politically, because she's very disciplined and very, very scholarly and very tight in her structure, always very tight, logically. Everything she does logically is always logical. She is very unemotional. And her politics carried the same notion, and her discipline of me carried the exact same notion, because she was the aunt who had the most influence in my life in terms of discipline.
Oh, you lived with her in the same house then?
She governed me. For example, I was strictly disciplined in terms of getting out my lessons, which meant that I came home from school and did those lessons before she got home, and that when she got home, I had to present to her a review of the lessons and that there could be no mistakes. Mm-hmm. If there were any mistakes, she would just make me do over the whole damn thing. And that whenever there were mistakes, she would point out to me what the logical mistakes were and how I could not afford to make those mistakes. And it was just her tight, within her mind, tight working, which I certainly picked up in the last few months. So very glad that I have, in terms of when you present arguments, how tight they must be. And she always insisted upon this, and her politics had that characterization of being very, very tight. So when she argued with people, she always had a tight argument that was almost impossible for them to break. And she always kept saying that nothing matters in the world but politics. Kept saying that over and over again, that everything else is subjugated to politics.
Is she involved in politics now?
Oh, yes. She's very much involved with the Eric Williams faction and Trinidad. She just came over here this summer, and we had a long talk.
In those days, was she working in labor movement and politics, or purely with the politics?
No, she was working very strongly within the labor movement. She was a school teacher and quit to work as a store clerk in one of the big department stores downtown. I think it was Gwendolyn and Sons or something like that, which was about the biggest store, to begin to organize the people in the store clerks.
What is her name? She sounds fascinating.
Elaine Littren, L-E-T-R-E-N. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you came to the United States, was there any difficulty in coming in? Because I recall up in Canada that although Canada allowed young domestic females to come into Canada, they strictly kept out as much as possible the male Jamaicans and so forth. But you found it easier to get into the United States?
Yeah, well, because my mother had already been a citizen.
Ah, I see.
And so had my father, so that...
Well, they'd be naturalized.
Right, so that I just rode in, so to speak, on their naturalization.
Now, they had come in the, 30s or something, to the United States, or 40s?
Early 40s, around
during the war, then?
44. Right.
I see. And it wasn't difficult then. Would it have been difficult for a Trinidadian to get in, say, after the war or in the 50s?
It would have been difficult. See, my my grandmother, was an American citizen. She had been here, so my mother came in through her. My father used to work with the Merchant Marines, or got in Merchant Marines paper and stowed away. That is, he got on a ship, and when he got to the United States, just got off and never got back on. Used a different name while he was here. And then the immigration caught up with him and presented a case in court, and they allowed him to stay and gave him his citizenship paper.
So there were special circumstances which allowed you to come in that mightn't have been. It might have been as easy for your friends down in Trinidad. Did any of them try to come up and fail to get in?
Not that I recall.
Now, when you came, we get into the American phase. This matter of identity. Did you find when you came here that you were surprised by some of the problems that some Americans face, Negroes face, with regard to their identity.
Yeah, well, that was certainly a big question, because for me the question of what was beautiful had already been defined by black people in the island, and that the question of what was beautiful was now defined by white people, for black people even, so that there certainly was a big gap between that, and that all the images that were now reflected, for example, across the television screen were white images, which were contradictory to what I knew to be black images. So there was always a gap, certainly. And that the discipline that my aunt had instilled upon me, and certainly in terms of reading everything I got my hands on, every book I read in America just had different images that I had known, which just left black people out completely.
Mm-hmm. This is a debilitating thing, this matter of identity. If people feel, now I'm a Welshman, and you grow up in Wales knowing that your country was conquered, and all your heroes that you're given in the history books and in the literature, in the popular literature, are always English heroes. And if your own great kings or leaders appear, they appear as fools or knaves. And this has a fantastic effect on the psychology of young people growing up. And I'm aware of how deep this goes and how it debilitates people being willing to speak up for themselves and assert themselves and accept responsibility for themselves.
Yeah, but the question became even clearer for me, because in the West Indies, the textbooks tried to show British as the greatest people in the world. And that when I came to the United States, it was the United States saying that they were the greatest people and then documenting the fact that they had beaten up the British. So that it became clear in my mind, it was just a question of who's the conqueror and who's trying to run the best psychology upon its subjects.
And who's writing the history books.
And who's writing the history books. Obviously, Sir Walter Raleigh and Drake and Scott were supposed to be my heroes. Rudyard Kipling was the poet laureate of the island. Queen, I remember my one upsetting incident with any royalty was, I think, Princess Elizabeth. She was then Princess Elizabeth, would that be correct? Mm-hmm. 1947 or 48. She was coming to the island of Trinidad. And I was made to stand in the hot, blazing sun with a blue serge pants, or starched white shirt, stiffly starched white shirt, with a yellow and black tie, blue socks, and black shoes that were just spotless, with my left hand at my side and the Union Jack in my right hand folded under me, held in front of me. And I had to stand in that position and dared not move, because I was told that we were doing something good and that we shouldn't move. And also I didn't want to move because I didn't want to mess up everybody else. For 3.5 hours, just to see this little white lady come riding by in a closed carriage and smile. And it was beyond me why I had to stand there for 3.5 hours just to see this.
You were with members of your school,
school.
No youth organization or anything.
No, the whole school, but the whole island had turned out. Mm-hmm. And everybody all over the island were waiting and quite exuberant about the fact that she was coming. And I couldn't understand why. And my aunt was, of course, against it, you know. And there again became a pillar of strength. She was saying that it's just nonsensical that black people should be made to stand up while somebody who's exploiting them come riding by, and that it must be stopped, that it was ruining the minds of the young people. Certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
I just stood there while she came by, I guess. That was my only introduction to nobility in my last, I hope.
Now, you came to America when you were 10. What year was this? This was about
52.
And you went to live with your father, I take it, and mother?
My father and mother and one of my aunts, who also mm-hmm. brought me up, who was the complete opposite of my aunt, Elaine. Not at all disciplined, not logically tied, very emotional. very lovable, however. Came with us, and then I then met my two younger sisters who were here, had since been born since we were in the West Indies. They had come back to Trinidad once for a short vacation, and we met them, so there were 8 of us.
And where were you living in this country then?
We were living in the Lower Bronx, Stebbins Avenue, which was a slum area. I remember my first day, we went to an apartment building, and I thought that we owned the entire apartment building, only to find out that we were to occupy three rooms, all eight of us. And I just couldn't understand that, because the conception of the United States was a country just overflowing with milk and honey. The sidewalks were paved with gold, and everybody had enough, and nobody ever wanted. And to be put into, and the, you know, just to see the conditions were just contradictory to me. You know, I wanted to go back home.
You'd had much more room for in the Trinidad.
Absolutely. There were no recreation centers.
In New York, when, right, for, in your neighborhood?
Right. I mean, it was just overcrowded. People were just always in the street, just clamoring in the street, it seemed to me. And these buildings represent prisons more than houses. Most of the time for us was spent on the street, because there was no room for us to sit in a three-room apartment, and that in order to do any reading, it had to be done on top of the roof for me.
You went to school in the Bronx, in a neighborhood school then, did you?
Right, public school 39, which was overcrowded. Terribly overcrowded.
Was it all Negro or mostly Negro?
Black and Puerto Rican, yeah.
Do you prefer me to use the term black?
Yeah, I prefer that because I think it arises a sense of black consciousness among blacks, yeah. Black and Puerto Rican, terribly overcrowded. I was supposed to be put in a grade ahead of the grade that I was in, but I couldn't be put in there because that grade was overcrowded, so that I had to stay in the same grade that I was in for a year. I remember my mother was very, very upset about that. I wasn't too particularly upset. There wasn't anything being taught. I knew everything that was being covered, so that for me to sail through that class with A's were no problem at all, and that the other bit of my time was devoted at the encouragement of my mother to read United States history, since I didn't know any at all. And I started reading the Horatio Alger myths and the Uncle Log Cabin stories of Abe Lincoln, how he struggled and finally made it and all that nonsense. And read a lot of, did a lot of my time reading, just constantly reading, since there was absolutely nothing for me to do. I don't think that I began to be challenged in terms of my intellectual ability until I reached high school in this country, that I sailed through all of those classes being an A student, merely because I'd learned all of that before in the West Indies, which then raised another question in my mind, that if Little Trinidad was supposed to be such a terrible place, how could it educationally be much better?